This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
This week, 14 peace activists on trial in Las Vegas, Nevada, were delighted to hear the judge say that he needed 2 or 3 months to render a decision in their case. The activists are accused of trespassing at the Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. Their actions were in protest against the use of drones as a weapon of war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. A drone is an unmanned aircraft that can be equipped to carry missiles. Kathy Kelly is coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence and one of the defendants in the case, and she joins me this morning from Chicago. Hello, Kathy.
Good morning, Jane. Thank you.
Now, where is the U.S. military currently using drones?
The U.S. military is using drones over Afghanistan and Iraq. The CIA apparently has the responsibility for drones that are flying and being used as weaponized combat drones also in Pakistan. And then it seems that drones are also being considered in Yemen and Somalia. We don't have as much information about that, and we don't have much accountability about any of these drone usages. And then drones are being used to patrol the borders both south and north of the United States.
So how exactly are they being used? What do they do?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that a drone that is airborne in another country lifts off of a runway in that other country. So, for instance, if people at Bagram Air Force Base outfit a drone with 2 Hellfire missiles and a 500-pound bomb to lift off the runway in Bagram, the control over the process of making the drone airborne is all based in Bagram. As soon as it's airborne, then the control switches over to air personnel at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and there are other bases now that are joining in this. But primarily, in the initial usage of the Predator drones and the Reaper drones, two of the weaponized ones, it was Creech Air Force Base personnel that were manipulating them. And so if you could imagine somebody who is looking into a camera feed coming from the surveillance drone inside of a dimly lit trailer inside of Creech Air Force Base, and then a companion is being in touch with not only the footage from the drone but also the messages from what's called a kill chain that gets activated if in fact the two airbase personnel believe that they have now spotted something that should be a target.
So then the camera in the plane is taking pictures which are relayed to Creech Air Force, and then the decisions are made about what to do with those missiles that the airplane is carrying.
Yeah, that would be a way of putting it. So say, for instance, days ago, I think it's a little over a week ago now, a Taliban unit had attacked a base in the Kunar province of Afghanistan. And the word was that the Taliban attackers had scattered over a mountainside. And so maybe through drone surveillance, I'm not sure, but some kind of aerial surveillance presumably identified people on the mountainside who were then potentially high-value targets because potentially they had attacked this police station. Well, the order was given to fire, and missiles were fired at presumed insurgents who turned out to be children between the ages of 6 and 12 who were out on the mountainside searching for scrap metal because that's how they could help build their family's income for food. And these kinds of mistakes aren't the exception. Repeatedly, we've been hearing about the combination of drone intelligence and intelligence fed to joint special operations forces in Afghanistan leading to murders, extrajudicial killings, assassinations, whether through night raids or death squads or drone attacks. And it creates rage. It creates antagonism. It may create generations of desire to enact revenge. And this isn't something that's being discussed in the public forum of debate within the United States. I think most people might see these drones as kind of little magic machines and not be encouraged by their elected leaders or by the media to think about it much more. You just constantly read an aerial attack killed 14 insurgents in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, and there's very little more to the story. But we think that a major problem with the drones is that they're being used in violation of any kinds of norms of decency or international law, because there's no guarantee that you've even got the right target, and the person being accused as a high-value target has no due process, no possibility to try and enact any defense, and we're not at war against Pakistan. So it's, you know, there's no question of trying to prove the just war theory components of necessity or last resort or discrimination. We're not even in war against Pakistan, and there's no due process for the people that are being targeted. There's just this institutionalization of assassinating, eliminating, eradicating people who might be targets of United States wrath because they might be posing a threat to U.S. security. Well, what about the people who live with them? Their children, their in-laws, their brothers and sisters. And so just since the beginning of this month, there have been 12 drone attacks in Pakistan, in North and South Waziristan, and 77 people killed.
Why do you think the U.S. military is using drones so extensively?
Well, I think it could be related to an election happening in this country. The current administration does not want to risk heightened casualty numbers in Afghanistan at a time so close to the election. And they want to be able to say that their strategy is working. And so General Petraeus has a kind of a short-term strategy of using both the Joint Special Operations Forces and the drones to make a trail that hunts down people that are believed to be part of Al-Qaeda or part of the Taliban network and just eliminate them. Well, we see this as an exceptionally short-sighted strategy because the blowback and the antagonism will be so very high. And even as it's happening now, there are attacks that are made against Pakistani civil society, against the Pakistani government, because the people that have suffered these attacks are saying, well, we can't fight against the United States arsenal. We're pretty puny in relation to the United States arsenal, but there's, a tendency to punish the Pakistani government and Pakistani civil society because of cooperation with the United States aims and goals.
Now, the actions took place in April of last year, the ones that you were on trial for this week. What did you do at the Creech Air Force Base?
Well, we vigiled for 10 days just outside the entrance to the base, and we hoped that the people going in and out of the base would see us as, you know, human beings who had a message that we wanted to communicate by virtue of our signs and our banners. We received many friendly waves and peace signs, and it didn't seem as though we were occasioning hostility. But we did also want to go inside the base and have a chance to both deliver a letter and, were it to be possible, to dialogue with some of the people inside the base about our beliefs with regard to very clear statements within international law, for instance, which does become part of the law of the land because of a treaty that has been signed in the past by the United States, that extrajudicial killings and assassinations are wrongful, that pilots are required to have assured that an order, even from a commander, has been verified through visual confirmation, and that the attack fills the norms or fulfills the norms of necessity, discrimination, and last resort. And I don't think those pilots are even aware of that rule. When those precedents were initiated, it came out of the Nuremberg trials when so many people had testified with regard to the death camps in Nazi Germany's warfare, that I am not responsible. I was only doing what I was told. Well, that doesn't fly when international norms are being invoked. People do have to, I believe, inform themselves about their responsibility. So we believe we were responsible, that we were acting responsibly, and also that we have a guaranteed protected right under the United States Constitution, which says that Congress shall make no law to abridge the right of people to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. We wanted to take our grievance right to the people who were directly involved with enacting what we believe are war crimes.
Why did the judge decide that he needed so much time to make a decision in your case?
The judge said that in his 25 years on the bench, he had never experienced a trespass case where the defendant didn't just plead, and then that was the end of the case. He'd never actually had a case that went to trial. So he said this was a first for him. And then he said that the presentations were all matters of such vital and crucial importance that he believed, as one human being, he needed more time to study before he could arrive at a decision, and that he wanted to take a good 3 months to study the issues and to study the testimony. And we felt that this was a great gain, that he had admitted the expert testimony of Ramsey Clark, Ann Wright, and Bill Quigley, and that this discussion, which we found really quite fascinating, we were just riveted by all of it, was something that now has gone into a transcript that he'll be looking over. And quite honestly, we all agreed that we'd rather be found guilty by somebody who took 3 or 4 months to think about it than to be acquitted by somebody who might say, well, it's getting kind of late and I don't want to miss lunch.
So what kind of testimony did Ramsey Clark and Bill Quigley and Ann Wright bring forward?
Well, the judge had been so insistent that we were not to present any questions or try to elicit any testimony that didn't directly relate to the charge of trespass. Well, with Ramsey Clark, you're talking to the former U.S. Attorney General during the Civil Rights era. So we just simply got, with Steve Kelly, a Jesuit priest, very adroitly and deftly guided Ramsey Clark through questions about people who went into lunch counters and sat down and had cups of coffee together, black and white together, and therefore were violating rules that said that they were trespassing, that they were, you know, not welcome at that lunch counter. And Ramsey Clark commented on many other situations where people have, for the sake of transforming a law and making it more just, have in fact violated the law, including trespass laws. So that discussion was very interesting, and then it was followed up by retired Colonel Ann Wright, who, with the diplomatic service in the United States and with a degree in law and having taught the laws of land warfare before in her career, began to talk about how she believes people on the bases in the United States are quite isolated, and that there is a need for them to be more aware if there is a greater debate that directly involves what they're doing and what they're enacting, that for the general public to bring that debate to these soldiers is something that she in her career believed was important, even if it involved a trespass. And then with Professor Bill Quigley, it was my turn to question him, and I just said, well, now, Professor Bill Quigley, you taught students about trespass law. What did you teach your students as far as the idea that somebody might be violating a trespass law in order to fulfill a higher duty? And then Bill spoke extensively about the need to narrow the gap between justice and U.S. law. And he talked about the 100 years law, which to him means the 100 years vision, which to him means that, you know, if you look back 100 years, you would be seeing all kinds of laws that legitimated violations against women's rights, against people who are discriminated because of disabilities, laws that said that the Jim Crow practices were okay, Jim Crow laws. These were all operative 100 years ago, and so it was the duty of the people who changed those laws to act as they did, and it's our duty, he believes, for the Creech 14 to try to have a vision. And if you don't have a vision, then, you know, hope is gone in terms of moving toward greater justice. So the judge then started asking Professor Bill Quigley questions himself, and I think that they had a very amenable discussion together.
Well, it sounds like you got the good judge for your case, and congratulations on that, and we'll keep in touch with you to find out what the decision is. And thanks so much for talking to us this morning, Kathy.
Well, thank you.
I've been speaking with Kathy Kelly. She's coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence.